Well, it's quite amusing and unusual to give a talk like that. I'm sorry. I couldn't make it really. Anyway, actually a little bit apprehensive how it will go. I even prepared some notes this morning, which I don't do usually, and I called them my water rule. Let me just begin with a few general words, some kind of general attitude to set the stage, although most of what I will be saying is, of course, well known. We usually begin our series with writing some positive low energy equations, like the Young-Mills equations, like the Einstein equations, like the Navier-Stokes equations, and it is understood that, of course, it's just an approximation, just a gradient expansion of some more exact equation, but for large wavelengths, we can use this. We can or cannot use these equations. So what do I mean, can or cannot? When we talk about the Einstein equations, we certainly don't have any doubts applying them at large distances. When we have the Young-Mills equations, we equally have no doubt that it is impossible to apply them at large distances because there are infrared corrections in the Young-Mills case, which qualitatively change the whole outcome. There is no sense in trying to solve classical Young-Mills equations in Minkowski space, and because it's all destroyed by infrared corrections. Now, the similar thing, for example, in hydrodynamics, we used to exploit these low energy equations without bothering about the infrared correction, but not always. For example, if you have a diffusion of a particle through random media from the, through the say solid with many impurities, it's described classically, it's described by the diffusion equation. However, it's well known that when the concentration of impurities is large enough, or if we are in two or less dimensions, or two or one dimension, then infrared corrections will kill completely this diffusion, and instead we have localization, Anderson's localization, which is a totally different phenomenon, which is 100% different from the diffusion equation. Now, I'm saying all this to just explain my attitude, because I think that introduction of the, that while the Einstein equations without a cosmological term, they certainly don't induce any infrared corrections. When you add the, because there are too many derivatives in the, technically speaking, in the interaction, when we add the cosmological constant, I think the situation changes, and that's what the work which I will be discussing today. By the way, I have to mention that the recent part of this work is being done with my student, Dmitry Krotov. This work is actually to locate possible infrared dangers for the cosmological, which hopefully will kill the cosmological constant. So, in other words, what's the technical way of doing this? We have to find a classical solution. In this case, in the case of the positive cosmological constant, it will be just the De Sitter space. We have to look at the global De Sitter space. We don't want to introduce any unreasonable limitations on this space, and then to look whether there are some large infrared corrections. And at this point, one might say that why should they be there? Because we do have, let's suppose that as a model, let's take some scalar massive particles on the diffuser background. It doesn't really matter, but it's just the simplest possibility to look at, because the mechanism of VOC is much more general. But just to be concrete, let's talk about this massive enough scalar field. In field theory, we used to the situation that the massive scalar field doesn't generate any infrared divergence. But it's not quite so when we have unstable spaces, and I'm not going to explain this. Let me give you a first. I will do it by example. Let us first look at a very simple object, just a nuclei which is very charged, with a large charge. Then we can hit this nuclei with a photon, and this photon will produce electron and positron, and so the threshold value of the photon energy will be equal to 2m, m is the mass of the electron, minus the binding energy. Now, as we increase, and so this is the threshold, and the correlation functions of photons will have singularity at this value. I say it again, 2m minus epsilon binding energy. Now, there is a gap, obviously, and there are no infrared problems which can arise here. However, as we increase the charge of the nuclei, the binding energy becomes equal to 2m, and then it goes, and then it becomes complex, but that shouldn't bother us. At the moment when it becomes equal to the binding energy, we get a supercritical nuclei, and the correlation functions of the photon field will have singularities in the momentum space corresponding to zero mass. And it is this type of singularities which, so we have some long-range correlations in the system when this happens. And that's precisely what I will be looking for in the case of the de Sitter space. But before coming to the de Sitter space, let me give you one more example of this long-range order which exists in the systems which are unstable or almost unstable. And again, I will take a very well-known example, the example which was discussed in hundreds of thousands of papers, the Schwinger's pair production. And but it seems that there's some, I don't know if it's new or it's known to the experts, but in any case, it was new to me. There is a certain long-range correlations which appear in this case. Namely, let's consider the case of 1 plus 1 dimension, and you have a vector potential. We can choose the gauge in which the vector potential spatial component of the vector potential depends on time only. And that's the standard stuff. We write down the Klein-Gordon equation, and then we can solve it quite semi-classically for more or less arbitrary, slowly varying potential A of t. And it is also, it can be seen that the WKB approximation breaks down when the mode characterized by the momentum K crosses the horizon. Here it means, in this context, it means that K, the moment of crossing the horizon, is given by the equation K equal to the potential A of T. When this is satisfied, the mode crosses the horizon. And then you can count those modes and calculate the current they induce. And what exists, what Schwinger calculated, or then, as I said, hundreds of thousands of papers examined, was the calculation of the current in-out current. And the point which we want to, the thing which we want to point out is that when you look at the when you look at the in matrix element of this current, there is a long, there is an infrared phenomenon, namely. I shall not be, the derivation is elementary, it's in simple semi-classical analysis, but the point is that the induced current is proportional, at the moment T, is proportional to the difference of vector potentials. Here is the main point, that you have to take A of T minus A of minus infinity. Or you can, if you want to express it in terms of electric field, you can easily do it, but it's not local. It's the integral from minus infinity to T of the electric field. So the in current is intrinsically non-local. There's an infrared, long-range infrared correlation. You can say, what's the big deal? It's just the Meissner effect. In the Meissner effect, we have, we also have the current proportional to vector potential. But what is slightly unusual to me is that in the case of Meissner effect and in the case of many other models, this non-locality is generated by massless particles. Here, in this model, which I'm talking about, there are no massless particles, but there is nevertheless non-locality because the system, because there is a possibility of Schwinger's pair production. So it teaches us something, that, namely that we should expect infrared singularities in the we should expect infrared singularities in the cases when the vacuum is unstable. And then we, as a next step, we notice the following. We notice the following. And by the way, returning to the point which just said, which I made before, the point which I made before, this, if I try to do the same thing, calculating using Feynman's path integral, calculating in-out current, this infrared effect will not be noticed. They will not be there. Actually, the induced current will be simply zero. Now, this leads to the rather peculiar case, peculiar statement concerning the De Sitter space itself, namely that there is the thing which I would call adiabatic catastrophe in such systems. What I mean by that? I mean the following. In the normal quantum field theory, when we teach our students normal quantum field theory, we say that when the S matrix, we introduce, say, phi to the fourth interaction, we introduce adiabatic switching of the interaction, and we say that the F matrix, which is the T product and so of the E to the I interaction, has a property that the zero to zero vacuum to vacuum matrix element of the F matrix, its absolute value is equal to 1, which simply means that when you adiabatically turn on the interaction, you don't the vacuum remains a vacuum. Now, the first statement which I would like to make concerning the De Sitter state is that if we take the Bunch-Davis vacuum and calculate the vacuum-to-vacuum matrix element of the F matrix, the result will be not 1 but 0. Moreover, the probability for generating any finite number of quanta in this vacuum will be 0. So the probability for when you adiabatically turn on phi to the fourth interaction, you are supposed to create infinite number of particles. If you take infinite interval of time, the matrix element of the F matrix tends to 0, and that happens because the vacuum is unstable. Technically, let me explain where it comes from. Technically, it comes from the fact that when you calculate vacuum-to-vacuum diagrams, it has an imaginary part. In normal Minkowski vacuum, there is no imaginary part in such diagram when you go back from vacuum to vacuum, and that justifies the adiabatic principle. That's simply because there is energy conservation which prevents particles from being created from the vacuum in Minkowski space. Here, the energies can be positive and negative, or any conserved quantity in the De Sitter space is not bounded from below, so there is nothing to prevent it. Now, of course, I have to address immediately an important objection to this, which I thought of for some time. Namely, suppose we work in the Bunch-Davis vacuum. This vacuum is obtained by this Moller. By definition, it's the green functions which we obtain by analytic continuation from the sphere. So why not simply perform perturbation theory on a sphere? For the massless particles, it's clear that there are no infrared divergences there. And moreover, just a few days ago, a couple of days ago, I saw the judgments by Marolf and Morrison and by Holland, in which the claim was made that the green functions obtained by analytic continuation from the sphere have no pathologies. And I actually agree with the statement. Hello?
Yeah, we're still here.
Do you hear me?
Yes.
Is everything all right?
Everything's fine.
Okay. Question is, what I don't quite agree is the conclusion which one draws from this from this result. The result is, so why not indeed take this rule, this axiom that we just do the perturbation theory on a sphere, and then after all calculations are done, we just continue analytically to Lorentzian signature. Why I rejected this possibility in my paper? The reason is that It's a good theory. To understand the reason is probably the best. To take another example, the example of the black hole. Let's look at the field theory in the field of the black hole. Just the usual Schwarzschild black hole. We all know that it's very easy and natural to perform Euclidean continuation of the black hole. The black hole becomes the Euclidean geometry of the cigar. And if you have a scalar field on this cigar, it's a perfectly fine theory. You will not notice any pathologies when you work with this theory in the Euclidean. So we can say, okay, let's postulate, let's say that we simply calculate in the Euclidean and then analytically continue to the Lorentzian regime. What's wrong with that? My answer is that there's nothing wrong with that, except that it does describe a different physical setting from what we need. You immediately see that, after continuation, that it will describe a field theory with a fixed temperature. The temperature will be always related to the mass of the black hole in a standard way. Therefore, the phenomenon which we miss in this description is the evaporation of the black hole. What we are describing is what I would call black hole on life support. Namely, we provide black hole radiates and wants to evaporate, but we're surrounded by some mirrors or by something, and then send the quanta back to the black hole so that it is in thermal equilibrium, it's eternal, and that's what we are describing. So my conclusion is that by using the Euclidean description, it's a very cool thing. I love the Euclidean description, but you can never notice whether your system is stable or not. In the case of black hole, we would never we'll be able to calculate in this way the lifetime of evaporation of the black hole. It's a bit like in condensed matter physics or in plasma physics, it's the same thing. You can take plasma in consider two cases. In one case, you're surrounded with some reflecting walls, and the system will be in equilibrium at some temperature, but if the gamma quanta can escape through the walls, if the walls are glass walls or whatever, then the system will be cooling off, and we will not notice it if we use the Matsubara description of Matsubara diagrams, thermal diagrams. This is the reason to why I expect. So what are the rules that I'm using? You can ask this. My rules are very simple. I'm simply saying, let's take the Lorentzian manifold, the Lorentzian de Sitter space, try to use the Schwinger-Keldysh diagrams to describe these processes. And it is in this setting we can find or not find the infrared divergences. Our statement is that these infrared divergences are indeed there. And they are very much, if we return back to this toy model with Schwinger pair production, which I discussed at the beginning, the Meissner effect, the proportionality of the current to vector potential, basically means that the vector potential for the constant constant electric field grows linearly with time. So the Meissner effect means that you have a linear growth with time of the current. Something similar happens in the interacting De Sitter theory. I shall tell you very briefly what the results of the calculations are. To explain, by the way, maybe there are some questions or people want to interrupt. I would be very happy to respond to some.
I have one more, just not a question, a comment.
Huh?
If you do analytical continuation...
Excuse me, I don't hear anything.
Why don't you come down and speak into the speaker?
Oh, no, just louder.
Or just louder.
No, in the speaker it's easier.
So, I just wanted to say...
He'll come down to the loudspeaker in just a second.
Do I correctly understand about the analytical continuation from Euclidean signature that you mean the following thing? If you use Kelder-Schwinger with unstable, Kelder-Schwinger technique with unstable vacuum, you just get a different answer from the one when you do calculation in Euclidean signature and then analytically continue.
Yes, you are absolutely correct, yes. Yes.
Any other questions?
You get a different answer, but I have to specify a little bit. When you work in a complete De Sitter space, the answer is yes, you do get a different answer. If you try, which I find sounds artificial, but we nevertheless tried this also, if you, in the complete De Sitter space, we obtain strong infrared divergences, which are absent, obviously, in the Euclidean approach. If I restrict the region of integration by the Poincaré patch, I can always, or even by static patch, if I restrict it by static patch, then these infrared divergences disappear. And in some cases, not all, the whole thing becomes equivalent to the Euclidean theory. But for that, you have to really, it's a rather crude operation just to, in the loop diagram, to introduce the step functions guaranteeing this thing. Let me add one thing here to make it more plausible, this statement. We can ask, let's return for a second to the black hole. To the black hole case. In the black hole, you can ask why it happened, why we had no instabilities if we use the Euclidean approach. We don't notice any instabilities. Technical answer is that, as you remember very well, if we take this the Euclidean black hole, then make time Lorentzian, we described only the outside region of horizon. The Schwarzschild coordinate R is always greater than 2m. That was our Euclidean, complete smooth Euclidean cigar. And R remains greater than 2m. But in this region, we have no negative energies. So there could be no instabilities whatsoever, and we don't find them. However, we know that Hawking radiation does exist, and it exists because we have states with negative energy separated by the horizon. So here also, when you kill the region of space, where the negative energy comes from, you get a stable theory. And I'm far from saying it's a meaningless theory. It's a good and very interesting theory, but it just describes a different physical setting. So that's the answer.
All right, we have one more question.
Yes.
So I have a question in the following sense that so when you consider the Schwinger-Keldysh type of calculation, one thing which is important also is to provide what is the initial state that you are providing. Let's say you're considering closed coordinates in the sitter and you provide some initial conditions, some initial state at some finite initial time.
Yeah.
The point is that there are several possibilities, but it seems that if one really wants to see whether it's possible to have the sitter invariant state, which is stable or unstable.
Repeat the last part again. I don't hear it. That's well. Yeah. What was the last part about? So I understood what I did here was that you are saying that, and I agree with that completely, that in order to specify Schwinger-Keldysh, you need to specify the state. That I heard from you. Now, what was the next?
The next point is that it seems to me that a natural state to specify for this discussion to see whether you can have a de Sitter invariant state and evolution with an interacting theory would be the following. One can try to use the Hartle-Hawking, this Euclidean description that you were referring to, the Hartle-Hawking construction to construct the wave function now for this de Sitter invariant state. So it would be similar to what you do with this Euclidean construction of the wave functional for a free theory. But now since you're interested in the interacting theory, what you should be doing is do the same kind of calculation, this Hartle-Hawking construction, this Euclidean path integral, to calculate the wave functional, this initial state, for the interacting theory. Because it's only when you consider the this kind of initial state for the interacting theory that you can hope to have, if you start with the free theory, with the decision invariant states for the free theory, then of course when you introduce interaction, you will have a non-trivial evolution.
Of course you have to modify the state with respect to which you are, theory takes care of it. We teach students that, both the operators and the states are changed by the interaction. Of course, but let me just, so indeed what I'm choosing is a ground state which Schwinger-Keldysh diagram takes care of correcting them to the physical ones. What I was saying is that if you define the rules of the game, if you, by simply saying, let's take Euclidean, do all the perturbations we like, and transform it into the Lorentzian. In this case, this physical setting does not describe decaying. You will never notice whether your vacuum is stable or not. It will be always stable. It will be the vacuum on life support. It will be always stable. You just introduce some magic devices to keep it stable. And let me just add one more thing. You see, about the choice of the vacuum, why we should choose the Euclidean vacuum or not something else. People are saying various things, that the Euclidean is more beautiful than the others, but we're not in a beauty contest, right? I think it's a physical way of approaching this is to try. There are several different vacuum states which you can start with, and we have to choose the most stable ones. So we take, when I say different vacuum states, I mean simply you can have different propagators in perturbations in the Schwinger-Keldysh. The state is specified when you say what the propagator is. Now, what do I mean by more stable? I mean that we should calculate the vacuum-vacuum S matrix, effective action, and the imaginary part of this effective action is different for different vacuum states. And although we cannot prove it now, our experience shows that most probably the Bunch Davis vacuum is the most stable state. So that's the when we try to calculate, we don't have a theorem, but when we try to calculate the effective action for other vacuum, For example, you can take in or out vacuum and so on, then we got a larger instability than for the diffeater. And for this reason, we just postulate the rule that we are in the Euclidean vacuum. But I'm open to trying some other vacuum just as well.
So maybe we can continue this discussion again. The only thing I was trying to say very briefly is that if you try to choose a different initial state, which would be the Euclidean vacuum, but for the interacting theory, not for the free theory, and then let that one evolve, then the correlation functions that you will get in the closed-time bus formalism are the same ones that Dolmarov and Ian Morrison got with their procedure. So all I'm saying is that their procedure actually has an interpretation in terms of the closed-time bus form or the Schwinger-Helbig formalism, just when you consider as an initial state the Euclidean vacuum for the interacting theory. So in a sense...
I do consider interacting theory wave function. It is the only thing. I would agree with you if you say that this would be the case for the Poincaré patch. However, if you consider the global diffeater space, I certainly disagree with this statement. Mm-hmm.
So we can continue with the discussion at the end. Thank you very much.
What?
We can continue this discussion perhaps at the end of
over the coffee break.
Thank you.
Over the coffee. Oh, we have 5 more minutes.
Okay, but I will tell the dean. Very good. So what we tried to calculate was the first correction to the Green functions, and what we found was that there are powers of logarithmic divergences there, and you can set up the problem of summing the leading, of finding the leading log approximation. Now the first diagram, let's consider, for example, phi to the fourth, or even easier, phi to the qubit theory, and calculate the first correction to the Green function. And I can just tell you the what the answer is. We certainly account for the change of it's a full interacting theory. It takes into account everything. And when you calculate Schwinger-Kelder diagrams on the global space, you will find that there are, we did it in two cases, in the global diffeater space and just to check in the Poincaré patch of the diffeater space. And the results are very different in these two cases. Although there are both logarithms, there are logarithms in both cases. In the global diffeater space, the result is that the Green function, the correction, the first non-trivial correction to the Green function, contains the logarithm of the infrared cutoff. There is a logarithmic true infrared divergence there. And if we consider a small coupling constant, we just can set up summing terms like lambda, like the coupling constant multiplied by the logarithm to the nth power. Although here I'm saying something which we didn't completely prove, but I think it is correct that the summation of the leading log approximation, which still remains to some a lot of work to do there, is presumably given by the Boltzmann equation, and namely because of the negative energy state, the vacuum generates particles, and the vacuum produces particles, and the occupation numbers are changing, and you can describe this for the weak coupling by writing the Boltzmann equation for the occupation numbers. And then you see that indeed the average occupation number become infinite because of this adiabatic catastrophe. But this is the case This was the case of the global decision space. Now, as we impose in the Feynman diagram, as we impose the step functions which constrain us to the Poincaré edge, which is very easy to do, the answer changes. First of all, it turns out that because of these step functions, the theory, the amplitudes, the fields don't have, they don't go to the past infinity, their past is not rich enough. In other words, there is no infrared divergence there, but there is the divergence of a different kind. If we take all calculations which we did can be summed up by saying that if you take the green function at large distances, then there are corrections to it proportional to the logarithm of the distance. The logarithm of the distance and how shall I put it? Those logarithms accumulate. The ansatz, which is consistent with everything, is the following. That consider the green function g of z. That is the distance, that's the logarithm of the distance. It is equal to some normalization factor, which depends on the logarithm, multiplied by the bare green function. Just the bunch theory's green function, but calculated at the renormalized value of the mass. So the effect is not very dramatic, but quite interesting. I believe that one probably can obtain this effect from the Euclidean. I think the fact that, again, the working hypothesis is that if you don't see true infrared divergence, then that means that the Euclidean approach should give the right result. In the cases when you have true instability, then you get those infrared losses. So, I'm coming to an end. Repeat my main points and I will finish. The main point is that unstable vacuum, like the vacuum of in electric field or the de Sitter space, I will, by the way, notice a strong analogy between positive curvature and electric field and positive curvature and negative curvature and magnetic field. So ADF space is perfectly stable, nothing happens there, like in the case of magnetic field in the Schwinger case. So in those cases there are long-range correlations. The main new thing, which this was new for me, was that there are even in the massive theory, there are long-range correlations related to instability. If you stabilize the system somehow by putting mirrors around the black hole or something like that, then you really can have a good theory described by the Euclidean in the Euclidean approach. What the Euclidean approach is not good for is to decide whether the system is stable or not. Well, let me finish by just saying that, I actually forgot to say one more interesting thing. But maybe I will, if someone is interested, I will do it during the question. The interesting thing, there's one more part of the whole subject which had not been touched, is to write down a string sigma model and use DS CST correspondence to describe to describe these instabilities. This is a huge subject, and I just want to say that it the subject exists, and I probably cannot go into any details here. But even apart from this, I think it's a fascinating new part of quantum field theory. I learned a lot of new things about quantum field theory working there. And I think it's very fortunate that we have some untouched territory, huge untouched and interesting territory in front of us. So let me stop here. Thank you.
Thank you. We have time for one or two questions.
I'm not sure I understand your Schwarzschild black hole analogy. I thought the instability is manifest in the Euclidean formalism in the negative modes found by Gross, Perry, and Yaffe.
Yeah. But you see, I was talking about different things. There are both negative modes, but there are no negative modes for the scalar field. Suppose you fix the background, and you introduce a scalar field on this background, then the scalar field doesn't have... There are negative modes in gravitational sector, but I'm not discussing the gravitational sector yet. What I'm discussing is a scalar field on a cigar. And what I'm saying is that the scalar field on a cigar is perfectly stable.
But is that not physically the case? If there is no dynamical gravity, then a black hole is stable?
What?
A black hole is stable and does not evaporate if you neglect...
You have clearly particle production, so the field itself, if you start, one can hardly have any doubts that if you have scalar field in the series, then there will be pair production, one component of the pair will be inside the horizon, the other outside, and this will lead to the eventual, when you take into account back reaction, which I didn't do, that will lead to the black hole disappearance, but the scalar field, what I'm saying will be lost in the Euclidean description is the fact that you can have pair production, window-like pair production of the scalar field by the gravitational field of the black hole, and that's what I'm. At the moment, I'm indeed my setting was very limited. I was just looking at fixed background and behavior of fields without back reaction on this background. Clearly one has to go further than that. But you see, my point is that in the Euclidean you will never notice this pair production of the electric field. So in other words, it's instability not in the gravitational sector but in the scalar field section.
We have another question.
I was wondering how far you can push that analogy between positive lambda and electric field versus negative lambda and magnetic field, since if you had magnetic monopoles, then the magnetic field would be unstable as well.
With magnetic monopoles, the magnetic field also can be unstable. Well, I didn't really, you're right. I just looked at some simplest things, perturbative things, and it's, of course, non-perturbative, we don't really know. Well, I don't believe the ADS space will be unstable, but at the moment, all I can say is that if I repeat this naive perturbative approach to ADS, then everything is, all these effects I was discussing are not there. There are no indication of any problem with the ADS space. So, non-perturbative, it could be.
One more question, I guess, for me. Can you tell us about the more interesting thing that you were talking, that you didn't want to tell us right now?
About what?
The more interesting thing that you found working on this that you...
Well, how shall I put it? It's mostly the fascinating things that one of them I didn't touch in this talk, which is this DFCFT correspondence and instability. The other is that I refresh my interest in physical kinetics, and I noticed that there's a lot of analogies between the so-called weak turbulence, which is described by kinetic equations when the wave interacts randomly, and the pair production in particle production in the theta space. Well, it's, but generally I find the whole thing, you see, I can tell you maybe a little more than that. Namely, you see, I spent many, many years in believing that I started with the Euclidean approach, and I started believing that time is, after you work for 40 years with this, you start believing that time is really imaginary. And now I'm discovering that it may be real, after all.
Any other questions? One more question.
I don't hear anything.
It's coming.
I was wondering what happens in global resistor space in your approach if you look at the phi squared interaction.
Yes, yes, yes. If you look at the phi squared interaction, it will also, because if you, it depends how you introduce this phi squared. If you introduce it adiabatically, then because of, so you introduce some time-dependent mass, and then you start turning it on slowly, it will actually change the vacuum, and it is not, it will not be, so it will lead to the non-trivial effect. It's, in other words, the theory where you, from the very beginning, you see, we have to get used to the fact that we have no adiabatic principle here, that we have adiabatic catastrophe. And because of that, the phi-square interaction is leads to some non-trivial changes of the state.
Okay.
So that, you can, it does lead to the infrared divergences, etc. A little bit like when you have a massless particles and you have a propagator of the massless particles and you start a massive particles and then you take mass to zero and start expanding in mass, you get non-trivial singularities because the leading term is 1 over p squared, the next term is m squared divided by p to the fourth and so on. So, for the massless particle in Minkowski space, it's not surprising, but here we have particles, massive particle in the de Sitter space, and they still behave as if they were masses. So, it's like with this Meissner effect, which would not surprise anyone when we have massless particles in the theory, but for me it's quite surprising to find it in the
Okay, well, thank you very much, Sasha, for doing this. We really appreciate your time.
Well, thank you. It was fun.
So now let's take a copy break.